Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 Project, here on the Nerd Party Network, where every 2 weeks we look at two films from the A24 filmography, and in between we bring you interviews with the talent involved in front of and behind the camera. In this episode, I'm joined by filmmaker Joshua Z. Weinstein to discuss his acclaimed movie, Menasha. Set within Brooklyn's ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, a widower battles for custody of his son. Joshua takes us behind the scenes of this film, which is presented in the Yiddish language, and the challenges they faced and overcame in bringing this film to audiences. Thanks to Joshua for joining me, and I hope you too will enjoy this interview.
What ignited your sort of passion for pursuing a career in the creative industry? You're a director, cinematographer, musician. You wear quite a lot of hats, Joshua.
Well, I always go back to, high school for me, which opened me up to punk rock. And even though I was born in New York City, I mostly grew up in the suburbs. And everyone played in punk bands I grew up with, they in their garages. And, we had these VFW halls, which were basically places that ex-military would hang out in, and they had bars, and then next to it they had like their little communal hall, which they'd have small weddings or gatherings in, and then they'd rent these out to high school kids to have punk rock shows in. So we'd just be yelling and screaming and bouncing off the walls while these old drunkards were in the other side just enjoying their peers. And this is a lot of my formative experience. But was really exciting to me about this was that, kids I knew were making music that I actually loved. And it just demystified the whole idea of what art was. If art wasn't something that had to be made, with millions of dollars and had to be prepackaged and advertised and you had to have gatekeepers and all these things, if art was something that your friend sitting next to you in algebra class could make on a cassette tape, it just changed your mind about, it's not about the means, it's about just saying something that only you could say, and what is your voice and how do you express it.
Was it a challenge to go from this type of passion to making it more of a career? How did you sort of go around making that transition?
Sure. So I went to college at Boston University, and the whole time I was playing music professionally at the same time that I was in college. So, and I mean professionally, I mean we were touring in the summer, we were getting paid to play gigs, but it wasn't like my main profession. But at the same point, we attracted a pretty decent following. I mean, it was so cool to like, go into a store and hear your music or see someone wearing your band's t-shirt when you're on the subway. So, the band I was in had a little bit of a following, and I really thought about dropping out of college to play music full time. And so the whole time I was getting my regular liberal arts degree plus studying film plus playing music. And when it came to graduating from university, I basically talked to my band and I was like, if you're serious about this, let's do music full time. If you're not serious about this, I'm going into film full time. And they just couldn't, they weren't ready to do music full time. So I said, I'm going to change my course right now. Because the thing about music, I mean, I love music. It's nothing like writing a song, practicing with your friends, and 3 days later playing it live for people. There's something that punk rock ethos, that idea that like, we just figured it out and we're going to do it. I mean, it's electrifying. It's the whole point of art. Art is about making something and sharing it with audiences. And, film is so different that you think, you write, you produce, you edit, and then, 2 years later, people are finally watching your film. So there's really an intellectual and emotional exhaustion with film, but at the same point, people I played music with, and I'm not talking about my band, I'm talking about the bands we toured with. I mean, so few people read books or read the paper or really knew what bands influenced the bands they liked. And there's just a real lack of historical awareness and depth. And I just found a lot of the people that I knew in the music business to be not that curious about the world around them. So as much as I loved it, and it was an incredible time to be, you know, between the age of 18 and 21 and just playing concerts all the time, I just started to find it boring a little bit.
What was it perhaps about kind of film and working in that kind of industry that maybe started to appeal to you a bit more than the music one?
Well, my whole goal was to travel the world for free. I mean, so same thing with music. Like, it was a dream. I got to just play in like 30 states in America, and just, you know, that was all paid for through the music. And then I kind of loved, I mean, things that I loved in film were really documentaries. I loved nature documentaries. I loved, you know, people exploring the world, and I wanted a free plane ticket. So becoming a documentary cinematographer allowed me to work all over India, Africa, Asia. It was just a way to explore and understand and hopefully share something human. You know, I really believe that all art, whether it be music or film, is a way to show how we're more alike than different, and to share some common, you know, soul, common humanity with one another. And that was most interesting to me, was to take these stories and somehow make them universal.
For those who might be discovering you for the first time listening to this, or only know of your work on Menasha, what would you kind of recommend people seek out from your back catalogue of work? You know, you've obviously worked on a range of films, adverts, documentaries, so many different kind of forms. What would you recommend if the people were having a Joshua Weinstein, like, marathon or evening?
Well, I made two hour-long documentaries that are available online. The first one's called Flying on One Engine, which in some ways, I made that when I was 22 years old, and it just is everything I wanted to do with storytelling. It's about a disabled Indian doctor who does free operations for children in India, but, you know, it's not your typical humanitarian. He's a curmudgeon, lush misogynist who insults the Mother Teresa. And it really makes you question what are good intentions, and people who are revered, who are they really? And this film, you know, for me, it was, I think art is discovery. So definitely, I thought I was going to make a typical documentary, but at the end of the day, I really tried to make something a lot more complicated. And I think it taught me while making that film that that there's so much more to what we originally see, and that no matter how good our intentions are, there's something more complex and complicated happening there. So that is actually free on Vimeo. I just posted it a few years ago, actually, just because I wanted people to see that. Another doc about an hour that was on PBS USA, and that was called Drivers Wanted, and it's about a cab garage in Queens. And my mom was a cab driver, my grandpa was a cab driver in New York, and just like Menasha, it's you know, a really deep dive into a world and subculture we don't really understand or see, and it takes apart the stereotypes. So those, and that's like on Amazon and a bunch of other places. And then I just have two more shorts, I think, that are really, one's really fun and one will kick you in the stomach. But there's a short I made that's on Vimeo as well. It's called I Beat Mike Tyson. It's a portrait of this Irish boxer who beat Mike Tyson. And I just loved looking at this character who, and tried to understand the simple concept of what if the best days of your life behind you, and what if what you're famous for, what you're known for, is actually something that was almost a mistake in history. And it looks at, you know, his relationship with his family while he's still losing fights. And then the fourth, just small thing, and that's about 13 minutes. And the last one is like a 6-minute short called The Holocaust Survivor Band, which is on, I did for the New York Times. And it's just a comedy about the Holocaust and these two 8-year-old men who started a band together. And again, it inverts the whole idea of being a victim and what you'd want to say about a Holocaust survivor. So you know, those four kind of, and each one of those docks, they, if flying on engine was the, was my first, and the Holocaust survivor was the last of in that order, and I made them all before I made Menasha, but you can definitely see Menasha in all these films. And then me as a director, I kept on, and this is why I had to make Menasha at the end, because I kept on making the documentary subjects, I kept on collaborating with them more and more and having them, you know, reenact their lives more and more in camera. And it's not reenacting, like forcing them to do something that they wouldn't normally do. It was talking to them and saying, look, I could be here 24 hours a day in your bedroom for a week and just keep their camera recording on you. And eventually, you'll hate me and I'll hate you, but we'll get a film here. Or, you know, you could just do a few things with your child here and talk about that conversation you're going to have with your wife behind closed doors now in front of me. And, you know, and I could just leave in a few hours. And, you know, when your documentary subjects realize that you really care about them and that you're trying to tell a human story and you're trying to really get to the heart of what they're saying and not the PR piece of it. I mean, again, if that's why it's so hard to make documentaries, is that you have to find the right collaborations. And but anyway, as you go through that list, you'll see that, I mean, I wonder if you'll see it or not see it, but for me, I'm controlling things more and more and more in each one of those projects, so that by the end of it, it is Menasha, in the sense that, you know, it's I would think of scenes, I would have people do things, I would and Menasha, by the time I made that, you know, it was completely, obviously everything was staged, and but it's informed by humanity, it's informed by reality, it's informed by lots and lots of research.
Obviously, this brings us to Menasha, and this was a film that I caught by complete freak maybe 3 years ago at the Edinburgh Film Festival. It was one of those ones you see lists of films at film festivals and you just walk into it, and it was like, forever. You know what, I'm going to go into see this film, check it out. And it was one of those ones, I think I saw it at 9 in the morning, left misty-eyed, and it's been one of those ones I've been fascinated by. Not the film is so good, but how it all came together, because this is such a unique film that had so many challenges and barriers that I'm just really fascinated to dive into with you. When did this film first start to form in your mind? And was it always your ambition to direct this project?
Yeah, so I finished undergrad in 2005, and then I made my first doc, Flying in One Engine. It was at South by Southwest in 2008. So, you know, within 2.5 years, I made a feature, I mean, this hour-length doc that got a little bit festival attention. And pretty quickly, in 2008, I already knew I wanted to make a fiction film. But, you know, it's coming from the doc world. And again, so I make my living as a cinematographer, and I've worked with so many amazing documentary directors. So my whole network of amazing collaborators are all from the doc world, and just learning to make, and another important thing for me is, besides coming from the doc world, is that I don't want to have to worry about making money, art for money or money for art. I mean, I just wanted to be able to make a film on my own terms. I didn't want to spend years of my life raising money for that. So between 2008, when I started to seriously consider making fiction films, and 10 years later, when Menasha came out, you know, I had slowly been making some shorts. I mean, I've been teaching myself how to make fiction films and trying to find the right collaborators and, you know, diving into it. So while Menasha seems like it comes out of the blue, you know, I'd already DP'd some fiction movies, and I'd shot some fiction scenes just to practice. So, you know, it was like 9 years of me like working my way to make Menasha very, very slowly as I was making a living and supporting myself and doing other creative endeavors at the same time.
What was it about this story that got you excited, that this was your sort of your goal in mind to kind of get this script written? What was the genesis of the idea?
New York City is an inspiration for me, and of those, you know, four other films I talked about, only one of them doesn't take place partially in New York City. Like, even that film I made in India, part of the film took place in New York City as well. So while I was doing all these other things, I was also doing a lot of still photography where I would just go all over the city and you get off the subway stop and, you know, here is the Ghanaian community in the Bronx, or here is a spring Indian holiday that's happening in Jersey City. And here are one of my favorite scenes in Menasha is this Lag BaOmer scene. Lag BaOmer is the big bonfire you see. And I had already photographed that a few times. And going to all these events in the city where you suddenly see, like, here is a very tiny microcosm of the world, but somehow, you know, once you put it on a street in the middle of Brooklyn, it interacts with everything around it, and then it changes and it becomes part of the city's fabric of and population and people. So what year did I go to Lag BaOmer? Oh my God, in Purim. But probably around 2011, I had, or 10, 2010, I probably saw that fire ceremony for the first time, and then I knew I wanted to make a film based around that. And so, but again, you know, making a living and doing other things, other projects, I didn't actually seriously. So basically, 2015. I had one of these kick you in the face kind of summers where I shot a documentary for PBS about end of life care, and I was in ER for a month just filming people who were dealing with end of life issues and watching them, you know, pass away on a daily basis. And then I went for a month to work on a project about tuberculosis in South Africa and India, and I dealt with a lot of them. Very ill patients as well. And after those 2 months of just being away from home and also working on really emotionally difficult projects, I wanted to see my wife every day and go to sleep next to her. And somehow making Menasha after that, I was just jazzed. I was just, here's my time. I'm ready. I want to do something that is just, yes, it's going to deal with issues of life and death and the complexities of existence, but it was going to be more relaxed for me because these were going to be actors reenacting something that was real to them versus me having to, you know, deal with actual ill people. So I think it was after this very, very traumatic, creatively traumatic summer for me that I knew I was ready to leave documentary for a little bit this film.
What I love and respect so much about this film is the ambition to cast real people from within that community and the excitement and, you know, challenges that it presents. Was that always your kind of goal, was to get real people and put them in front of the camera? Or was it potentially the thing of going, hey, why don't we hire, you know, traditional actors, you know, that person's got a headshot, and we'll make a film, you know, around those people? Was this always your aim?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm thinking of my favorite films, especially the films that influenced me for this, and it's, you know, Bicycle Thieves, the Dardenne Brothers, the Pooh Trilogy, and all of those films, which I think are masterpieces. Those are real people. I mean, maybe there's a few actors or, like, you know, people who acted for a few days once in their lives, but they weren't like people who are auditioning 5 days a week and on Broadway or in a TV show. And so it didn't even cross my mind to think about calling up Hollywood and being like, wow, you know, wouldn't it be awesome if Brad Pitt could wear some payas and a beard show up in Borough Park in the summer with us and sweat his ass off in 110 degree weather. So I never even thought about that, because what was going to be special about Menasho was it could only have been done the way we did it, which was very tiny crew, a very long time filming, and finding real people, because their existence is the film. If we made it any other way, it would have been boring. It wouldn't have felt alive and like these characters were about to fall, you know, not show up to set the next day, which they always threatened us. And some days they didn't show up to set the next day. So I think the not knowing it couldn't have been done. Knowing would not have made it better in any way. But the only actor in the movie who's not from the community is the son. And so, blah, 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 blah. Oh my God, there's so many stories to tell. Once I knew I was going to make this film, I didn't really have a story at all. I just knew I needed to research. And I just went around the community wearing a yarmulke. I grew out my beard. I wore a white shirt and black pants. And, you know, people didn't think I was ultra orthodox, but they did think, you know, they thought I was a Jewish person, which is true. You know, I didn't lie about that at all. But I did try to wear the clothing to blend in as much as possible. I started meeting people, and it was really fun. I got to observe the world in a way that you can never do with a documentary. You can never walk into the camera and go to the places that I went and see how, I mean, I'm just thinking of people would take me. I remember I went up to the Catskills, and there was a man who had just been thrown out of the house from his wife. And then I followed him to the gas station where he was trying to buy food. I don't know if he didn't have enough money. And then he was calling the Pakistani guy anti-Semitic terms in Yiddish. And just insane things were happening to me. And again, they're so out to left field that you couldn't even begin to put them in a script. But at the same point, you start to see a little bit about the psyche and about how the outside world reflects the inside world. I'm talking a lot in circles right now. Where are we going with this? Oh, the Hamam Menashe. So anyway, so then during all this time of meeting people, I eventually met Menashe. And then I would do screen tests with them, where I'd bring the camera out and just see what they would do on camera. And I actually just posted a video of this on my Instagram account, where you get to see some of the test footage and then how it edits into the film, actually, the actual performance. And my Instagram account is just my full name, Joshua Z. Weinstein, and you can find it right there. It's like the first video up right now. And immediately, Menashe was just far and away the most interesting, talented actor. He just had innate abilities, and he was just really watchable. So once I knew it was Menashe, and I started hearing about his story, and he really had a wife who passed away, and he really lost custody of his son. So just hearing about those two details, I knew there was a story that Menashe wanted to tell himself, and that not only did he want to tell it, but he had this sad clown quality to himself, that his emotions were right there on his face. And there was something very, heartbreaking about him. So we then created a fictional account of this, of his real life story. And then we had to find the son. And the thing is, once we found the son, Ruben, so he grew up speaking Yiddish, but his parents are not religious. And once I found Menashe and Ruben, I did a test film with them and just saw how loving and emotive they were together. I knew that no matter what happened in this film, as long as we had these two main actors, we could write around any other issue we might have while making this movie. So I found Ruben. So I probably found Menashe in the fall of 15, and I found Ruben in like February 16, and then we were shooting the film in the summer of 16. Oh, I'm confusing it. Sorry, it's 14. My dates are all wrong. We found Menasha in fall 14, and we found Ruben in January 15 is when. And then we were shooting in the summer of 15 is when we started shooting.
One thing I've always been curious about, with especially bringing in sort of non-traditional actors, is how challenging is that for you to direct? Some of the shorthands and points of reference between directors and actors, was that sort of non-existent and you had to almost develop your own language for sort of communicating what you needed and maybe what the actors were needing from their director?
In a good way, you know, my job was to create an environment to make them feel the emotions that they should be feeling, and to create a set and to create surprises for them so that they were not acting, they were responding to reality. And that's all an actor really does. I mean, should be doing is they shouldn't be acting. They should be responding to another human, to the way the water is coming on their fingers, to the way the sun is falling on their skin. You know, they you can't look. Your emotion shouldn't be on your face. It should be a response to the stimuluses around you. And I think great actors do that. Great actors can really be in the moment. So again, it was just getting the actors to be in the moment. But some of the actors really, I think there's, you know, a few hundred thousand ultra-Orthodox Yiddish speakers in the area of New York City. And we only had about 40 kind of show up for auditions. So we didn't have a huge bucket of people to work with. So I don't want to, you know, talk badly about any of the performers in the movie, but some of them I had to give line by line, and we just had to go line by line and just get and cut it together in post. But they still were incredible. You know, incredible was the uniqueness. I mean, they still were themselves. And I think when you watch this casting tape, and then when I worked with the performers, it was just about finding out who they were and just writing roles that fit who they were, and to have them be themselves. And it's really hard to be themselves because I can't act. As soon as I get in front of the camera, I see the lens, I see the lights, and I just stiffen up. So anything normal or funny or endearing that I do in real life, I can never do on screen. So it was often just about making them forget about everything and just having them exist in the moments that we needed them.
I suppose on the other side, how challenging was it for you to kind of direct or take in sort of the portrayals of the actors when they're talking in the Yiddish language? Is it one of those ones, again, it's sort of create there, you're kind of getting an environment from them? How do you sort of understand what's happening out of, almost in front of you?
Oh my God, it was exhausting. It was because a scene that would take 2 hours would take us 8 hours. And so one, we would rehearse in English. So we would walk through the scenes in English so everyone knew what to do and could, we'd all be on the same page. And also the great thing about doing the scene in English first was that when the actors switched to Yiddish, it would be like saying the words for the first time. So it took out the practice actorly thing. They could just concentrate on doing it for the first time again. And then on top of that, we had a translator translating the English script into Yiddish. The actors would sometimes complain and say, this Yiddish is not the correct translation. And then when they said the words, we had a live translator on set in another room listening to the audio, speaking back at English, and Alex, who produced and wrote the film with me, he would then be checking on it. And then the actors would get annoyed with the translator and say, you know, when I want to say you're stupid, I wouldn't say you're stupid, you know? I'd actually say you're like a teacup that doesn't have hot water in it, you know? And then the translator would be like, no, but that's only if you're from Hungary. In Hungary, they say that, but in Czechoslovakia, they say something else. So it became like a biblical debate on stage often, and everyone was trying to outprove themselves about their Yiddish-English translation abilities. But thank God Menashe and Ruben said worked really well with the translators, worked really well with each other. So the working with Menashe and Ruben was a joy. And every time I had them on set, was just them, was super relaxing and fun. It was just when we had the whole other circus that showed up, it would, you know, you'd wish that there was more drugs for everyone to share.
One of the things that surprised me at the time when I had first heard it was, obviously you touched on it a bit earlier, that the film was shot over 2 years. What were some of the challenges, especially probably working with young kids, and actually the rewards of this approach of shooting a film over that period of time?
So, I mean, it was and it wasn't. So we did 2 weeks in the summer, and again, I'm getting my dates about wrong, but I think it was summer of 15, we did 2 weeks. Then we edited, because we also, it was such an experiment, the film, the actors, just, I mean, to see what was working. Like, we weren't entirely sure what was working and not working until we really got into the edit with it. And then we shot a few days between that. Okay. There was really just two main shoot periods, which was the summer of 15 and the winter of, and around February and in 16. But then we shot a bunch of days, you're right, within a year of those two things. Challenging of it, getting actors to show up. Like, sometimes we'd find someone in a casting, you know, 7 months earlier, and it's like, where do we find this actor again? Where does the actor live? What's their number? Do we even have their name right? and they wouldn't even believe it. They didn't even believe we were calling them. They're like, what? I didn't come in for an audition. I don't even remember what you're talking about. And then there was pressure, like, while we were making the film, people were calling us. I mean, because we had one, Danny Finkelman was one of the producers, and he's ultra-Orthodox himself. And people would call him, and people would call Menashe and say, "Don't do this movie. This is you're going to get in big trouble if you do it." So there's all sort of external pressures. Ruben, the son, he was living in America when we started the film, and then he moved to Israel while we were making the film. So he had to fly out for Israel twice to work with us. So obviously, keeping this motley group of actors together was the only thing that mattered and was the hardest part. But the benefits of it were, you know, I think when we got into Sundance, there's literally a hole in the movie that said that we are shooting the scene, and we shot the scene, I think after we got into Sundance, we shot a new scene for the movie, which is brilliant. You know, when you're making a film that was very, very cheap to make, and I could, you know, it's awful, but some days I'm lighting the scene myself, shooting the scene myself, editing the scene myself. And again, not to say we didn't have an amazing team who kicked their ass to make this movie. We had a great gaffer, and Yoni shot the film with me, and we had amazing editors work with me. But, you know, we just couldn't afford them every day. Or they weren't available every day. So, you know, some days I had to do things that I would have been a lot happier if I didn't have to do it all myself.
One thing that you've touched on is your background in documentaries. And what I really loved about Menashe, and I think makes it such a kind of memorable and special film, is that I kind of touched on this in my episode when we reviewed the movie, was that I came away and learned so much about this community. I'm used to maybe seeing them when I visit New York, on, you know, seeing the Hasidic community perhaps on trains and or in the kind of the north of London. But I really came away learning so much about their community, and especially the dynamics between widowed men and their children and what happens kind of after that. How much did your sort of background and documentaries play into sort of how you presented this information, so that audience members like me will not just get a fantastic drama, but really come away and go, you know what, I've learned something about a community that I take for granted that I know anything about?
For sure. And I love, you know, kind of like while I was researching this movie, and I think, you know, it was about how many months? Probably like 7 months from the time I thought about making this movie to the time we started shooting this movie. I wrote a list of scenes, of moments, of things that I experienced. I mean, I love that there's a rabbi. You put a picture on the wall, and it keeps the mice away. So the goal was this list of moments and and specific, oh my God, it's already been so many years since I've kind of thought about all the things that excited me, or the mikveh. You know, I love, you know, religious men go and immerse themselves in water almost every morning in that community. So there's just a whole bunch of things that I saw that inside this kind of loose narrative, I wanted to just live in these moments. And that's what excites me the most about filmmaking, is combining this ethnography and putting it in narrative. And what's, I mean, trying to think of my favorite movies. Every year, my favorite movies are the ones that are not about this tightly drawn narrative. It's about, I really love that I saw a new world and experienced it in its own way. And I think Honeyland, did you see that
last year? Yeah, I did. Fantastic.
Yeah. And again, Honeyland, I loved Honeyland. And I think that anyone who makes docs or makes narrative should watch Honeyland, because the moments in that are just, I mean, they stay with you, and all the details of keeping bees and putting them in walls and putting them in trees. Like, if you didn't spend time with a beekeeper, you wouldn't know that that world existed. But I would love to talk to those filmmakers and understand how much of that film was set up for camera. Did you feel it was staged at all, that film, or did you feel it just captured it as is?
I felt like it captured and so on. It was one of those ones, again, it was similar to Menasha of like, oh, this is an interesting subject, and being kind of really taken with it by when you get into that cinema and going, wow, I did not know this, 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 and this. And it becomes one of those ones, your knowledge that you kind of gain from these films becomes almost the way you advocate for this film, going, wow, you should really check this film out. It's fantastic, you know, as a drama, but you'll learn this, this, and this. And I think that's kind of rare that you get films like Menasha and Honeyland that sort of kind of thread the two so well.
Yeah, and I thought it was brilliant that Honeyland got nominated for both Best Foreign Film and Best Documentary at the Oscars. It was just cool that it was recognized in both ways.
Absolutely. One thing that could almost be a documentary or something that was kind of filmed, you know, in itself was, this must have been the first time that a lot of the cast will have seen a film. What was their reaction as the film started to kind of go out into the world on the festival circuit and they got to see themselves on the big screen?
I'll tell my two. One of my favorite moments was once it opened up in theaters in New York City. It was like bringing Borough Park into Manhattan, and no joke. On this must have been the Sunday screening, the weekend it opened up, there were so many ultra-Orthodox Jews in the screening, and again, their rabbi, supposedly the word was, you shouldn't go see this movie. But if you do, I heard it's not so bad, is what the rabbis were saying. That's supposedly what the rumor mill was. And so a lot of ultra-Orthodox people showed up. And then after the screenings, and in Angelica, which is this movie theater on Houston Street near Broadway, it was in two theaters. So it was just like back to back to back, screening, screening, screening. And the Jews would leave, and then they'd have prayer services in the hallways right outside the cinema. And literally the manager would say, you're making too much noise in your prayer service. You have to leave. Because religious Jews pray three times a day, basically. And the bits to fit it in, people would get out and start. And again, sorry. And the other thing with religious Judaism is you have to pray with 10 people when you pray these three times a day. So if it's time to pray in the afternoon, you need 10 people, and you go in the corner and then you all say the prayers together. So they were doing that right in the movie theater. And anybody who went to see the screening that Sunday, I think I can't imagine what it was like to hear the prayers, feeling the subway underneath you, because this movie theater is right on top of a subway, so it kind of rattles a little bit, you know, every 5 to 10 minutes. So you're feeling the subway, you're hearing real prayers outside, and you're watching this movie. I couldn't imagine a more New York City experience than that day.
You should have got that rabbi's quote on the poster. I think that could have been one for the ages.
But another awful thing that happened was at Sundance, you know, there's the typical press, which you talk to a reporter and they write an article for the a blog or a paper. And then there's more creative things like, oh, let's film you doing something silly and we'll post an interview of you doing that. And one of these things was you sit on a bed and you get an interview of yourself on a bed. And so we got this request, and I told Menasha, look, I think this, you know, could just be misinterpreted. We shouldn't do this. And Menashe was like, nah, it's no big deal. What's a big deal? Let's do it. So anyway, so it's me and Menashe, this reporter, is a male reporter between us. We're all laying on a bed and they're filming us and they posted it online. And sure enough, someone took a photo of this, of us on a bed, and gave it to the rabbi in Menashe's community. And said, Menashe, and there quickly there was a rumor mill in Menashe's community being like, Menashe's in a bed with men, Menashe's in a bed with women, Menashe's filmed in a bed with women. You know, it's like, you know how people just make up rumors and it gets worse and worse and worse. And so people came all the way to the rabbi, and people were trying to get Menashe to kicked out of his apartment and out of his community. And so the rabbi's like, what? I hear you're in a bed with woman in the movies. And Menashe's like, nah, it was just a couch. It's no big deal. And the rabbi's like, okay. And you got this day. But it was just very easy to have people think the wrong things. Because there's so much misinformation, so many people. And again, in Menashe's community, you're not supposed to use the internet at all. So a lot of people couldn't really fact check what was happening out there, outside.
What was the post-production period like for getting this film sold to distributors before, say, A24 came along and won the rights to this film in America?
So we... Like, basically made this film. We had some small investors, but it was very tiny, you know, very, very tiny budget. I think we shot the film for like $80,000, I think is what it cost for like a year of production on the movie, which, you know, is still a fuck ton of money. But, you know, for movies, $80,000 is not a lot. And so at that point, we really didn't show it to anyone. But before Sundance, Chris Columbus had just heard about the movie, who, like, you know, he directed Mrs. Doubtfire and Home Alone and Harry Potter, and he heard about it, and we just didn't need money till we were done editing it, and we sent it to him, and he just loved it. He fell in love with it, and he gave us a little bit of money to finish some post-production on it. But what was most important, even than the money he gave, which was super important, was that, you know, here was, like, a real Hollywood director being like, no, I like this movie. This movie has merit. And he said that. So I thought it was very helpful that just changed the perspective that instead of us just being some tiny Jewish movie that was, you know, low budget, no one cares, it was all of a sudden was, wow, this is like a movie that Chris Columbus is excited about. It happens to be about Jews, but, you know, you should check it out. And I think that just changed a way, in a good way, where we were so fortunate that he took the time and to watch it and to care about it. I really want to say, especially Eleanor, his daughter he works with, was one who saw it first. And Eleanor was the one who brought it to Chris's attention. But anyway, Eleanor and Chris together, coming to Sundance with them, was super helpful. But we purposely didn't show it to distributors. We only showed it to actually one distributor, and that was Sony Picture Classic, because Sony Picture Classic had a real history of doing great Jewish films over the last 20 years. I mean, over their whole history, and making them very successful. So we thought Sony would be perfect for us, but they were just very slow to offer us a deal. And at Sundance, we had a bunch of other distributors come at us, and when we started talking with A24, you know, obviously their history and the cinema they've released in this very short period of time just spoke to me, and we couldn't have been more fortunate, you know, couldn't have found a better home for the movie. And and they were just on top of it and responded very quickly to everything. And, you know, all the other distributors we talked to, they all were great. And, you know, I don't want to say there was, they're all, who knows what the history is and what other films we'll make in the future, and hopefully we can work with them too. But it just, the quickness that A24 got the deal together and how serious they were just, you know, really impressed us. And we couldn't believe that this little movie was going to be in the, they promised so many theaters, and I don't know how many theaters. Was it like 200 theaters in the end of the day throughout the United States? It was, at one point, it was, I think, in 30 theaters in just the New York City area, which I just couldn't believe that a movie that I made could be in 30 movie theaters around New York City. And the two movie theaters in Manhattan, these two main ones, Angelica and this one on the Upper West Side that's closed now, it was in it for months, and it was just great that people were constantly seeing this movie in New York. I couldn't believe it.
I hope whoever's listening to this that heard that little nugget of Christopher Columbus gets that added to like the IMDb trivia for Menasha. That's a real gem for something like that.
Well, I love that. It's awesome. It's somewhere between Mrs. Doubtfire and Home Alone, the movie, in its own way.
One thing I was curious as well is, like, with when you get something like the A24 brand kind of at the beginning, do you find that it brings in a different audience as well? From, you make this film, as you say, it had this huge Jewish community came out and supported the film. People like myself are caught at festivals. Do you find people watch your film in sort of their filmography watches, where they go, hey, this is a film that it takes place before a good time in their filmography, I'm going to go check that film out. Has that had sort of an impact on it?
For sure. It was so hard, you know, because marketing a film is different than, you know, making a film. And I really didn't know what to do or how to do it. And A24 did kind of, I think, market this as more of a Jewish movie than maybe I would have wanted it to be. But at the same point, you know, I'm just a working person, you know, and if they thought this was going to make the film the most money to make it more of a, you know, I'm talking about just the colors, like the main poster was this kind of blue color with just a close-up shot of Menasha in Hasidic garb. And it just felt like, oh, you know, in a good way that this would appeal to Jewish people. So I think the fact that that is the A24 brand, and people did see it along with other movies, opened it up to a bigger audience. But I'd love to actually see the breakdown of who watched this movie and what percentage of it was like older Jews and what percentage of it was, you know, just the regular cinema going audience.
I'm always curious as well, sort of what's life been like for you post Menasha? Have you kind of thought about directing a non-fiction film again? What's kind of things been like for you since?
Yeah, I wish cinema was a faster art like punk rock, but unfortunately it is very slow, and now I have a baby, and, you know, just making, you know, enough income to support my family is important. Is obviously more necessary than it used to be when it was just me and my wife. So so the next film that hopefully I'm going to shoot later this year or early next year just took a lot more time just to get money together to make it happen and to get the team together. But you know, everything looks like it's moving in the right direction. So I'm really excited about it. I just wish it would have happened, you know, the year after Menasha and not 3 years after Menasha.
One of our kind of final questions, and we pose this to everyone that we get on, what are some of the highlights, apart from obviously your own film, and I would have it on my list, is some of the highlights of the A24 filmography for you?
Oh, man. I think Florida Project is my favorite film that they've made. I think Sean just did everything that I like to do in cinema. You know, take you into this very insular world that has so much fun and humanity, but there's also some deep sadness there, and it's just beautiful, enjoyable film to watch. So that's, I'm a huge Florida Project fan. I think Moonlight is one of the best films of all time. I just think it's perfection in so many ways. I literally, if you didn't cry during Moonlight, I think I lost you as a friend when that came out. It's it's really perfect. So, and then the Safdies, I mean, I love their last two films. I went to college with Josh and Benny, so I've been watching their since their shorts they made in college, and it's just been incredible to see them develop as artists, and to see that. And Uncut Gems is just so perfect in so many ways. Lady Bird, so fun. And Greta's incredible. It was really fun being with her at the Lady Bird came out the same year as Menasha, so we were at some events together. So it was great getting to know her. What are your favorites?
I think for me, I love Under the Skin. I think that's my number one. I just adore it. And I think it's the fact that it's one of these ones that it's filmed partly in Scotland as well, and it showcases, like, just now we have things like, as we speak, we have, you know, Fast and Furious has been shot in my city, one of the most recent Avengers films, all these sorts of things. But it's like seeing this unique sci-fi film kind of shot in your own country in such an alien way. I think that score, what Jonathan Glazer did, I just think it's just one of the most impressionable films I've seen in the past decade. And when you were touching on the Florida Project there, I never kind of clicked that sort of Menasha and Florida Project would make a fantastic double bill in terms of how they, you know, I watched both those films and I came away with a deeper understanding about a social issue and challenges that a single parent's face in America. I think that they'd be a really good double bill. So definitely, hopefully someone will do that. They'll put them both up on Netflix and check them out.
Oh man, and I think they both are on Netflix right now in America at the same time.
There you go. We have a perfect plug that we've just had there. So yeah, people should definitely get that on for their next Saturday evening entertainment. And kind of finally, where's the best places to kind of keep up to date with any sort of news, developments, you know, future projects that you have coming out, Joshua?
Cool. Yeah, I definitely use Instagram a lot, and it's just my full name, Joshua Z. Weinstein, on Instagram, and then definitely post on Twitter as well. And my Twitter handle is just @Joshua, just my first name, just my Twitter handle. So I post. There's something to tell. it's gonna be on one of those two sites.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Joshua. It's been a real pleasure to chat about Menasha. I think it's one of these hidden gem films, and I'm so excited to hear how you kind of brought this film to life. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, thanks, man. Stay positive.